When Jonathan Dekel-Chen goes to Washington these days, and he goes to Washington a lot, he brings photos. Mostly they're pictures of his 35-year-old son, Sagi. He wishes he could bring more.
A lot of the photos that we had for Sagi and for all my other kids and grandkids were burned on October 7th. It was not just a murderous rampage and hostage taking. It was full-scale looting and destruction.
Jonathan and his son are American citizens, but they lived on an Israeli kibbutz near Oz. When Hamas fighters invaded, near Oz was one of the first places they went. Sagi has been missing ever since.
I'd love to share all kinds of photos. Him as a little boy, as a baseball player. He was one of the few Israelis who actually knows how to play baseball by virtue of my addiction to the sport. And he bought into it, thank goodness, when he was a boy, so I'd have a playmate.
That's dedication. Baseball game takes some time.
It sure does. And he caught the bug.
This is the Sagi Jonathan wants lawmakers to know. The Sagi who is so much more than a photo on a missing poster. Not just a baseball player. He played on Israel's junior national team as a kid. He's also a tinkerer. He fixed broken down farm equipment by hand. And Sagi's a dad to two little girls, with a third on the way. On October 7th, he locked his wife Avital and his kids in a safe room, and he tried to defend his farm. When the day was done, he'd gone missing. The only reason his father knows Sagi was taken is because other hostages, people who've been released, have seen him. But that was weeks ago. So now, Jonathan's going door to door with politicians in Israel, in the U.S., to plead his son's case, urge them to send in the Red Cross to make sure Sagi's okay, urge them to bring Sagi home. After showing them pictures, Jonathan likes to leave mementos behind, one of those missing posters of his son, and a pair of these dog tags the hostage families have been handing out.
Which I think is a powerful symbol of humanity, really, more than anything else.
The dog tags say, bring them home, right?
In English, yes, they say, bring them home. And then in Hebrew, there's something else, Halev Sheli Ba'aza, which in translation means, my heart is in Gaza.
Months in, do you feel more or less optimistic about your son's fate?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer. For nearly 2 months, we didn't know if he was alive. We know that he was taken captive after a battle on the kibbutz in general and in and around his house specifically. We didn't know if he was alive. So the mere fact that as of, let's say, 2.5-3 weeks ago, we know that he was alive, that is an enormous, enormous source of strength for us and hope. But as I say, with the passage of time, that's not certainly nothing is for certain.
Today on the show, one family's hostage story. I'm Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next. Stick around.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
This episode is brought to you by Discover. When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 US-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Jonathan, you're an American citizen. Can you tell me the story of how you ended up moving to Kibbutz Ner Oz?
I grew up in semi-rural Connecticut, small town. I grew up in a community that mostly was not Jewish, but it had a strange characteristic that a fairly large number of Holocaust survivors and refugees from Nazi Germany settled there both during and after the Second World War. And my parents were among them. My mother was a little girl when her family was miraculously able to escape from Nazi Germany in 1940. And my dad was a hardcore Holocaust survivor, having survived 6 years in Nazi labor camps and concentration camps. So all of us kids of these Holocaust survivors grew up with a very strong Jewish identity. In my case, it manifests in this idea of eventually going to Israel and helping build what was a Jewish state, and graduated high school and went on my way.
What did Kibbutz Ner Oz offer to you? Like, what did you love about it? What did your son love about it? Because he must have loved it because he stayed.
He very much loved it. It's a way of life. A kibbutz, of course, for those listeners who don't know, it's a small cooperative farm. In our case, it's a community of about 440 people, multi-generational, in which it's a shared fate and a shared life.
You pool your resources.
Yes. And certainly in 1982, when I wound up there, it was very much that. It was a classic conventional kibbutz where you shared your resources. Life, you know, was very thin in the creature comforts, but that absolutely spoke to me because it was just this combined effort to make the desert bloom and to be there for one another in a very positive way, in a multi-generational way.
Did you grow things?
Oh, most definitely. Yeah. I've held a series of jobs. And after my mandatory army service, I became a kind of what I would hope to be an expert in irrigation. And after that, into agricultural machinery. And Sagi was one of my four kids. He really grew up in the agricultural machine shop and sort of being my tag along in the fields, supervising and servicing agricultural machinery. Our kibbutz is really cutting edge in terms of, or was until October 7th, a very cutting edge high-tech agricultural enterprise. In his professional life, he has really manifested that love of building things. His pet entrepreneurial project with his wife is to take old buses and refurbish them into usable objects. And the morning of October 7th, he was actually doing that work. It was a Saturday morning, also a holiday morning, and was his practice. He kissed his wife and girls good morning and went off to the kibbutz machine shop, which is about 200, 250 yards from his home. And his intent was to continue working. He had two of those buses he was working on simultaneously to convert into classrooms when he first spotted a group of heavily armed terrorists that had penetrated into the kibbutz.
Yeah, I know that you were not there on the kibbutz on October 7th, but that Sagi was one of the first people to send out a message to the group chat saying there are gunmen here.
Yes.
As a resident, like, did you get that message from your own son? Is it how you learned what was going on?
Well, I was in Baltimore on my way to an academic conference that day. We were woken up, myself and my wife, we were woken up early in the morning at about 6 a.m., woken by a friend in Boston who had been seeing on the news that something really bad was happening in the region of Ner Oz. And she asked us if we knew what was going on. Of course, I had no idea what she was talking about. But very quickly, once I turned on my phone, I did see what was going on. We have in the kibbutz a kind of group chats through WhatsApp. And there were multiple chats going on.
So you had this like live documentation.
Yes. Yes.
How awful to read through it.
The worst moment of my life up to that moment. Yes. I immediately called first my daughter, who also lives on the kibbutz, one of my kids. I have a son and a daughter who live on the kibbutz with her young family. They were able to pick up had a very brief conversation with her husband, actually. They were all sheltering in their attached bomb shelters. And he basically gave me the quick rundown that the kibbutz is under assault and there were literally terrorists outside their door.
When did you realize what had happened with Sagi?
Well, I asked my son-in-law, Yossi, if he knew anything about Sagi, and he said that they had lost contact with him at around 9:30 that morning, so roughly 2.5 hours.
Your heart must have stopped.
My world stopped at that moment. We also didn't really know what was happening with his wife, with Sagi's wife, Avital, and the two little girls. So we didn't know if they were alive until much later that afternoon.
When the dust settled after the attack, Jonathan was able to piece together just how devastating it had all been for the kibbutz and for his family. His ex-wife, the mom of his kids, had been injured and kidnapped, but she managed to escape right before being taken into Gaza. His daughter and her family survived. Jonathan says Sagi disappeared while fighting off Hamas militants. Of the 400 residents of Nir Oz, around 20 were killed, and an estimated 80 were taken as hostages.
The reason they were able to take so many, we've now sort of in the forensic thinking about all of this, the reason they were able to take so many of us was because the IDF never came.
Mm. Because hostages from Nir Oz made up such a large proportion of those who were taken on October 7th, they also made up a significant proportion of those who were released in November during the temporary ceasefire. And I know that you weren't expecting your son to be among those released because he's a man of fighting age who had indeed fought with Hamas. But can you tell me about that moment when you learned that people from your community would be returning? You must know these people quite well.
Let me frame it this way. First, I was thrilled. I was thrilled. These were my friends. Some of them had been my co-workers over the years. Young women who I had seen grow up. They're the age of my kids. Little ones who were dear friends of my grandkids on the kibbutz. So I couldn't have been happier. Couldn't have been happier at that moment. And recognizing that the alternative was much worse. The second worst moment of my life so far was eulogizing a few days after October 7th, eulogizing at the funeral a family of six, the Siman Tov Kedem family.
The entire family?
Grandmother, her son, his wife, and their three little children. They were all dear friends, dear, dear friends. They were my kids' friends. They were my grandchildren's friends. The father was shot outside of his home. The mother was shot through the door. They couldn't open the door. Then they set the house on fire, the terrorists.
And that's how the children died?
The three little kids most definitely died of asphyxiation. And it was, I was asked to eulogize them because of my closeness with all the family. And Carol, the grandmother, has been my friend since 1981. An American citizen, by the way, from Philly.
How did you begin to do that?
I couldn't write a word. You know, I tried the night before, and I couldn't write a word. I don't know. It's kind of a blur, to be honest with you.
It sounds like what you're saying is that when you got the news that many hostages from your kibbutz would be released, your gratitude was partially about, I don't have to do another service like that for these people.
That's right.
And I'm so grateful.
I think you're expressing exactly, because there were entire families who were taken, taken and or murdered. There could have been more funerals, and there still may be more funerals like this. We've already gotten death notices from about people that we believed were hostages. But over the course of the last 2 weeks, we've gotten notification from Hamas that they're dead.
And you must, of course, think of your son, too.
Every day, every minute. I mean, again, I do know as of about 2.5 weeks ago that he is alive. But every moment that passes, who knows? They're not receiving medical care. There are bombs falling around them. So there is a real feeling of distress amongst any hostage family, any and all.
We'll be back after the break.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
Around the same time Jonathan was in D.C., meeting with U.S. officials to push for the release of his son, a very different meeting was taking place in Israel. A group of hostage families and released hostages themselves were meeting with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his war cabinet to discuss bringing more hostages home. But leaked audio from this meeting shows it was tense, with family members shouting at the prime minister.
As both it. תגיד לי מה אני אמורה להגיד לאמא שלי? מה אני אמורה להגיד לה? כי לי אין לי דרך לנחם אותה.
One family member described the meeting to the press, saying, "It was a model of how the country of Israel is run. We were invited for 3 o'clock. They showed up at 3:45. They got us mad, and we fought amongst ourselves."
Look, these are desperate times for hostage families. I think magnified by the fact that we're getting now direct testimony, you know, eyewitness testimony from the hostages who have returned about how horrific the conditions are. As far as our government is concerned, I mean, keep in mind, this is a known fact. That meeting only happened, meaning the war cabinet led by Prime Minister Netanyahu, that meeting only happened because of a public shaming the day before by a group of hostage families in a very well-televised press conference, demanding a meeting. And we all are perfectly aware that in the first few days of the IDF assault, Prime Minister Netanyahu and others did not say much of anything about the fate of the hostages. He and others were forced to do so by the public outcry, led by the hostage families, of course.
Hundreds of people have gathered in central Tel Aviv for the biggest protest so far in support of the hostages and their families. And they're calling on the Israeli authorities to get their loved ones home from Gaza as soon as possible. They're calling on them to make it their top priority.
Now, when we've met with the entire cabinet, what we've heard is that taking down Hamas and bringing the hostages are equally important. This is incredibly disappointing because people are dying. We know that for sure.
And so there's not a lot of good news coming out of Israel in terms of the solidarity between the hostage families and our leadership.
Hamas has detained some hostages in previous conflicts for years.
That's right.
Are you preparing for that in some way? Like, how do you even prepare for that?
I don't think about that. That's not what I intend to happen. And I think all of the hostage families, of course, were painfully aware of that history. And we're doing everything we can to make sure that that does not happen.
Yeah. You know, I wanted your perspective on something because I've had a number of guests on my show who've said they don't believe the destruction of Hamas is possible. They think the idea of Hamas, the idea of this struggle, whether it's, you know, like the military, actual militarized group, or the idea, it's so embedded at this point that its elimination just isn't going to happen. And I know you've said that is what you need to happen here. So when you hear someone say this goal is not possible, what do you think?
Look, ideologies and fanaticism and hatreds are extremely difficult to eradicate. It's a long-term process, mostly through education, which isn't instantaneous. I have no illusions that religious fundamentalism of all kinds, not just Muslim, is very difficult to defeat or very difficult to eradicate. That is simply true, and I would not argue against that. But there's a different truth here, which is we've reached an inflection point in which that can no longer be tolerated, because this is the price. This is the price, this kind of savagery that was perpetrated on October 7th. What I would hope could happen here, and they must not allow Hamas, this kind of governing authority that planned, funded, and executed this massacre and this mass hostage taking, they cannot allow for the good of the world to be victorious.
There have been some hostage families who have been very explicit that they don't want their relatives' circumstances to be used as a justification for mass death in Gaza. How do you think about that, about your son's safety, about the calls to not eliminate so many thousands of people at this moment?
Yeah. Well, I wish none of this were happening and none of it were necessary. And I agree with those voices coming from the hostage families, not in his name, not in Sagi's name. Do not do this. Don't pretend that, you know, this is happening solely because of the release of the hostages. The war aims and the execution of the war, you know, have their own motives and their own justifications in the eyes of our own leadership, Israeli leadership. Israel or Israel's leadership has a moral and political responsibility to get these hostages home that is completely separate from the conduct of this war. Clearly, there's been a lot of loss of Palestinian lives over the course of the last 2 months. I don't think you'll find a hostage family that rejoices in that. Absolutely not. And I absolutely agree with them. Don't be doing this in the name of my son. You have no right to do this. What needs to be done to Hamas, you know, needs to be done, but not in his name. He would never agree to that either.
I worry for you, though. I worry because your son's still in Gaza, as far as we know. I think some would worry that his life is on the line as bombs fall. And it's a terrible potential price. And I know you must think about that every day.
I think about it all the time. And hence, I and many other hostage families are demanding from our government, from the Israeli government, to do everything now, whatever their other war goals might be, to do everything now to get the hostages home. And logic would dictate that the surest way to get them home is through a negotiated, some kind of negotiated process now. Look, my end game is, and I'm sure it's similar to all other hostage families, is for Sagi to walk down, and I dearly hope he can walk on his two feet, to walk down some hallway or into some room, and his two little girls will leap into his arms, and he will, well, I don't know if it'll be before or after Avital gives birth, because it's any minute now, and he will meet his infant daughter, and I'm willing to do anything and demand everything for that to happen for Sagi and the other 130 some odd hostages.
Sounds like you picture exactly what it'll be like.
I think everyone has that. All of the hostage families and their loved ones have a picture in their mind of what they're working towards. Because the alternative is horrendous. Unspeakable.
Yeah. You just did it there, but I do want to make sure that however we end this interview, we return to your son and his humanity and all of the joy he brings you. I was noticing that most articles about Sagi are accompanied by the same image.
Yeah.
He's very handsome. He's like bathed in sunlight. Yeah. He's got this smile. It's just like lighting him up from inside. Can you tell me about this image and how it became the one you shared?
It is a very, very characteristic photo of Sagi. The light shines out of him. He's hard-nosed, but he is probably the most optimistic person, or certainly among the most optimistic people I've ever met. He really does believe that if you do, and quite literally with your hands, do the right things, life will improve for people who you know and people who you don't know. I mean, in a way, he's, you know, kind of the living definition of altruism, you know, doing stuff for people that you don't even know. He lights up a room. He lights up every space. I don't know of a single person who has not met him and come away feeling that the world's a better place because people like Sagi are in it.
Jonathan, I'm really grateful for you taking so much time and telling your story in such depth. Thanks for doing it.
I appreciate your willingness.
Jonathan Dekel-Chen is a professor at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem and the father of Sagi Dekel-Chen. And that's our show. What Next is produced by Paige Osborne, Elena Schwartz, Rob Gunther, Madeline Ducharme, and Anna Phillips. We are led by Alicia Montgomery with a little boost from Susan Matthews. Ben Richmond is the Senior Director of Podcast Operations here at Slate. And I'm Mary Harris. Thanks for listening. I'll catch you next time.